This is Vis-a-Vis, a podcast series brought to you by the Alliance Program at Columbia University. Vis-a-Vis features conversations that challenge our understanding of key global, economic, and social issues by casting them in a transatlantic perspective. I'm Emmanuel Catan. I head the Alliance Program, a partnership between Columbia University and three French universities, Sciences Po, Paris 1 Panthéon-Sorbonne, and École Polytechnique. Every episode, I sit down face-to-face with, or as we say in French, vis-a-vis, some of the most insightful thinkers on both sides of the Atlantic. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Today, the average American teen spends 7 hours and 22 minutes looking at screens each day, an increase of 30% in the last 10 years. At the same time, 7 out of 10 teens say they often or sometimes feel more peaceful when they don't have their smartphone. The Surgeon General recently called for a warning label on social media platforms, and a California school district voted to ban cell phones and social media for students. In France, where teenagers spend 5 hours a day looking at a screen, a report submitted to the President of the Republic in April 2024 offers a wide range of recommendations, including improving guardrails and parental controls, protecting children against dangerous or illicit content, and providing training on a balanced and judicious use of social media and digital tools. Today, Vis-a-Vis has the privilege of welcoming one of the authors of this report, Professor Celia Zulinski. Celia Zulinski is professor of private law at Paris 1 Panthéon-Sorbonne University. She is specialized in digital law and intellectual property. Professor Zulinski is also the co-director of Paris 1's Observatory on Artificial Intelligence and a member of the National Committee on Ethics and Digital Technology. She is the author of Pour une nouvelle culture de l'attention, Towards a New Culture of Attention, published by Odile Jacob in 2024. Professor Zulinski, welcome to Vis-a-Vis.
Thank you.
In the book you co-authored, Pour une nouvelle culture de l'attention, you detail the multiple mechanisms used by digital platforms to keep us hooked. We're talking about infinite scrolling, pop-ups, clickbaits, dark patterns, etc., and how they rob us from our decision-making power. How can you explain what the risks are that are presented by these tools and what effect they have on children and young people in particular?
We can say that at the individual level first, there is a growing concern about the impact of design on digital services and users' autonomy and respect for fundamental rights. Because digital interfaces can exploit our cognitive biases to influence end users to make decisions that may be contrary to their interests. It is now well documented how captology techniques exploit attentional gaps. For example, the technique of encouraging users to share more personal data by accepting all the cookies is now well known. The Accept All Cookies button is typically larger, presented in an attractive color, usually green, and it is placed in a position on the interface on the screen that encourages reflex acceptance. Another common dark pattern is to make it extremely complex to unsubscribe from a service. This process is known as Roach Motel. It is designed to keep you in, and it's easy to get into, but hard to get out of. It is a maze that doesn't have an exit. And that's why Amazon has been criticized both in Europe and in the US for the subscribing procedure of its Prime service. Regarding the attention economy, design and interfaces can influence end users to use the service longer. We are all familiar with infinite scrolling and autoplay mechanisms to maintain the user's engagement with the service. And notifications can be used to encourage the end user to revisit the service again and again. Here, another factor has to be considered. the personalization of access to content by algorithmic systems. For example, the TikTok service is very significant. The For You page offers highly personalized content recommendation based on the user's interest and engagement. And the short video format used by TikTok facilitates the rapid input of data. And the learning algorithm can identify user preferences quickly and very precisely. So the more the end user consults the feed, the more it matches their interests. It combines all the components of an addictive process. The loss of temporal reference with infinite scroll, combined with ultra-personalized exposure to relevant familiar content with high social value, plus a dose of the unexpected and surprising. This is a real casino effect that captures our brains.
So my first question is, why is this a problem in terms of the time that we spend both as adults and as teenagers?
If we focus on younger end users, on children and teens, it may impact sleep, which is an essential factor for their development. And this can also contribute to their becoming more sedentary. And this is now well documented. But we have other risks which has been demonstrated concerning their physical and mental health, especially for the most vulnerable of them. In particular, I'd like to mention Amnesty International survey called TikTok Driven into the Darkness. The survey shows how the For You feed can produce a particularly harmful so-called rabbit hole effect. Notably, when a spiral of content promoting self-harm and suicidal ideation is recommended to certain users. Users who have been identified by the algorithm as interested in this topic. And the survey concludes that this exposes children and young adults with existing mental health problems to serious risks. In addition, we can tell that the attention economy in such digital context could also have pernicious collective effects. Because, as we know now, it is based on maximizing end users' engagement, algorithmic systems are led to favor certain kinds of content. In particular, shocking or hateful content and even false information. And this could contribute to amplify the recommendation of such content for all users. This influences the information we can have access to and could contribute to the polarization of public debates. Furthermore, professional information could become, let's say, second-rate content because clickbait information is promoted to generate the most advertising revenue possible. And this could lead to reduction of the overall quality of media content because some media could be tempted to adopt similar strategy to maintain their audience.
This points to the need for regulating social media and the use of digital tools generally. Many big companies have advocated for self-regulation. In other words, rather than imposing rules from legislators, they argue that it would be more efficient to let users decide how much time they should spend on social networks using some of the tools provided by the social networks themselves, like alerts on average time that they spend online every day or every week. Is that efficient? Does self-regulation work?
So now users can limit their screen time in general or per app and limit even notifications. And more recently, we have some platforms that have proposed to their users to switch to focus mode to not disturb sleep, personal activity and work. But we can consider that self-regulation is not enough. First, it may appear contradictory to consider digital services as a solution to the issues they create, given that their very model is based on capturing our attention. In this context, can they position themselves as the guardians of our attention without risking conflicts of interests? Furthermore, these tools emphasize individual responsibility. This could produce feeling of guilt and provide users with an illusion of control. Can we act independently in the face of the mechanisms designed to capture our attention? We can also argue that these screen time measures are not targeting the right thing. They do not take into account the question of content quality, nor the locking in of users by algorithmic mechanisms. And what's more, they do not address collective issues such as polarization and degradation of the information space. We need to go beyond self-regulation. That's what we argue. The European Union is moving in this direction, but we can consider the legal framework is still limited.
And talking about the European regulation over the last few years, the European Commission has indeed created tools aimed at regulating digital platforms. The Digital Services Act, or DSA, was adopted in October of 2022, and it forces large platforms like Facebook, Twitter, X, YouTube, Instagram, etc., to provide more transparency on the way in which their algorithms are designed, as you say, to capture individuals' attention. How effective has the DSA, the Digital Services Act, been? And could you point to some concrete examples where it has been instrumental in protecting consumers in Europe?
First of all, we can regret a limitation in the text, because the DSA only requires platforms to give the main criteria of their recommendation algorithm. Very large online platform that means more than 45 million end users in the EU will have more obligation. Here, they will also have to offer users an option based on neutral recommendation. That means that a recommendation have to be proposed not based on individual profiling, on personal data profiling. But the DSA still seems too limited in this respect, because it does not allow end users to define the recommendation criteria. And this would allow them to regain control and redefine their interaction according to their own interests. This is the first point. On the other hand, we can consider that the DSA is really promising when it comes to regulating the systemic risks that can result for the design of recommendation systems. It requires a very large platform to carry out an analysis of risks regarding their services. These so-called systemic risks are of several types. First, they concern the negative impact of the exercise of fundamental right of freedom, including free speech, media freedom, and pluralism. This also concerns the protection of human dignity, privacy, and personal data, as well as the protection of children and consumers' rights. Also, the impact of civic discourse, electoral process, and public security are covered, and the protection of public health and minor, and negative consequences for people's physical and mental well-being. So, platform will have to implement reasonable, proportionate, and effective mitigation measures, such as testing and adapting their recommender systems. This risk analysis and mitigation measures will be examined after by the EU regulators, which may question their effectiveness. We can already observe the potential impact of these new requirements. Just a few months after the DSA came into force, the EU Commission launched several formal proceedings to assess whether major social media have breached these new obligations. This is the case, for example, of TikTok, with the proceeding launched in February. Among other things, it is focusing on the design of TikTok's system, including algorithmic systems that may stimulate behavioral addictions and reinforce so-called rabbit hole effects. So the result of this investigation will provide conclusive evidence on this point, and we'll all expected that conclusion. Another example is a proceeding launched last May against Meta. It is also targets the risk caused by the design of Facebook and Instagram, which can exploit the weaknesses and inexperience of minors and cause addictive behavior. And let's remind that the penalty could be very important, up to 6% of annual global turnover, and even a ban on services in the EU in case of serious and repeated infringements. But there is one essential point. It is not enough to declare that the end user is authorized to act. The end user must be truly willing to act. And the conditions for such an action must be plain and guaranteed. So we must therefore avoid any instrumentalization of consent, any illusion of freedom. This is the whole point of the systemic regulation we advocate, promoting the interventions of all the actors and their coordination.
So how do you achieve this? What are the means by which you can empower end users? And does that involve training? And who are the actors concerned in providing that kind of power to end users?
First, it is important for end users to better understand the technical constraints they face. That means make them better informed, for example, by better understanding how recommendation algorithms work and what are their impacts. Better train the end user also, but they should also be able to act on these constraints. That's why we are proposing to give them a new right, a right that could be called the right to set, the right to define the system parameters. The idea here would be to offer them the possibility of configuring the tool according to their own interests, rather than letting their interactions guided solely by the interests of the platforms and their engagement mechanisms. In concrete terms, for social media, this right to set parameters could concern the definition of end users' content emission sphere. That means define who has access to the content that they have published. They should also be able to define their sphere of reception. That means what appears as recommended content in your newsfeed, for example. It also seems important that end users can vary the setting according to their context of use. For example, social media could be set up differently in a professional context than in a private one. We also need to consider the paradox of end users wanting to be in control, but not wanting to spend too much time on it. To achieve this, then this new prerogative could be implemented in two stages. For example, first, end users could simply select the content they come across and indicate whether or not they wish to be exposed to it. And secondly, the user would have access to an ergonomic dashboard in the application setting. And in this way, they could adapt their choices and when they want, possibly after taking time to reflect. If this right is to be properly exercised, the design must be such that to make the definition of parameters desirable. That means not offering a generic acceptance of all default settings. It should not to be too difficult to choose with too many options. It's also important to make the impact of the choice understandable. In short, the choice must be designed to encourage users to take control of their account settings. Failure to do so could lead to what we can call cognitive overstimulation, cognitive overload. And this overstimulation generally leads us to delegate our choices to the machine. So this could have the opposite effect to that intended. Other proposals are also promoting even more advanced settings. That means enable users to choose from a plurality of algorithms within the platform itself. This is the idea behind the Blue Sky project, for example, enable the use on the platform of third-party application to organize contact recommendation or moderation. And in this way, pluralism could be reintroduced into the platform. Another challenge could be to respond to effects of platform design on our attention. In the book, we propose to work on identifying end users' automatisms to separate those that serve their goals and interests from those that deviate from them because they are being manipulated. We have used examples from the spheres of computing engineering, air traffic control, nuclear area, and others. Because in these fields, designs create automatisms to ensure system safety, and the operators of these high-risk systems have to think about the actions and automatisms they should have. Considering social media, it would encourage end users to take a step back from their own behavior and uses. This would ensure that end users are better protected against the spread of online hate speech, exposure to misinformation and disinformation, and even compulsive mechanisms, as we mentioned. We could also mention the protection of young users, of course, through setting that could evolve as they become more autonomous. As we mentioned in the report, you mentioned the screen and young people submitted to the French president last April. Beyond that, this right to set parameters may seem essential in the context of chatbots and the multiple interactions we have and will have with these chatbots. As we know, there's only one answer given to the user's requests, but this could be problematic because the criteria for determining this answer are not known. This may limit the user's choice.
Right. And the report that you mentioned, the report that you submitted with a number of other experts to the French president, makes a number of very concrete and practical recommendations regarding the use of screens, in particular, in the lives of children and young people. It suggests that cell phones should be introduced at the age of 11, not 9, which seems to be the norm otherwise. At the age of 13, children may have access to smartphones, but without connection to social networks. And at the age of 15, teenagers may have access to ethical social networks. What are ethical social networks? And secondly, what has been the reaction to these recommendations? Are they realistic and how can they be enforced?
As you mentioned, the report contains a large number of proposals. It proposed a new systemic approach that aims to put the children back at the heart of our concerns. Because we think that our children are the wealth of our society. We must insist on one central point. Our children are not for sale. They cannot be exploited by economic actors. So some of our proposals are aimed specifically at digital services. For example, tackling and banning the addictive and restrictive nature of certain digital services to help young users choose again. Protecting children rather than controlling them, taking into account harmful contents, of course, especially shocking and traumatizing content. And at the same time, seriously preparing them for their autonomy in digital services. That's why we need to educate and train children in digital technologies and help them discover and learn how to use them. Assuming and organizing a progression in children's use of screen and digital technology according to their age. With this gradual approach, the goal is to support children and teens from a situation in which they are largely protected from exposure to screens at the start of their lives to a gradual acquisition of autonomy in terms of use and equipment. An important and complex point is to allow access to ethical social networks, you mentioned, only from the age of 15. The aim of this proposal is to protect minors not from all social media, but more specifically from certain content, functions, models, and environments generally described as harmful for them. So, on the one hand, we need to identify an ethical model that should be prohibited. And we propose a set of indicators, including, for example, exposing children harmful content without activating the default safety settings, or collecting their sensitive personal data, or harming them through advertising systems, or through algorithms, particularly those based on addictive feeds. Or we can mention also harming children through incentivized and engagement features, in particular through exposure to likes and comments, or leading to the adoption of compulsive behavior with no time limits. This proposal may be in line with others being discussed in the US, especially to ban addictive feeds, I think. For example, in the state of New York, the SAFE Act aims at prohibiting the provision of addictive feeds to minors. On the other hand, the goal is to promote the development of ethical social media, in particular, social media that aims to take the user's interest into account, for example, by offering the possibility to define the settings, as we discussed previously, but also social media that encourage collaboration rather than commitment and restriction. And with a number of colleagues, we are now going to continue our work in this direction by bringing together an interdisciplinary team to promote these new models, so to promote this new culture of attention.
Celia Zulinski, thank you so much. You've been very generous with your ideas, and thank you for sharing these insights on some of the challenges our young people, children, but also adults face in navigating the world of social media and digital content. And thank you for these promising ideas about empowering all of us and helping all of us develop healthy habits in our interaction with the social media world. Thank you again, and see you soon.
Thank you.
Vis-a-vis is brought to you by the Alliance Program, a partnership between Columbia University, Paris Panthéon Sorbonne, Sciences Po, and École Polytechnique. This podcast is produced by Monica Hunter-Hart and Georgia O'Neill, and I'm Emmanuel Catan. Special thanks to Columbia Libraries. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. If you're interested in learning more about the Alliance Program and how we support academic exchanges, research, and collaboration between the US and France, please visit us at alliance.columbia.edu or follow us on Facebook, Twitter X, and Instagram. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening.